Hello and welcome to this special podcast of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined again by our proper horror show, Chloe, who I've previously had a few discussions on her channel, which you should definitely check out, proper horror show, about horror films. And I've also had a discussion previously about the history of British censorship from the BBFC onwards into the modern period. And today we're going to be talking about the career and filmography of Stanley Kubrick, at least the early part of his career, which honestly, as somebody who considers himself a Kubrick fan, he's not my favourite director, but he is up there. He's made, I can't argue that he's made some of the best genre films ever made. Whenever he's tried to tackle a particular genre, he tends to be up there with the greats whenever he does, particularly with a horror picture like The Shining. This is a part of his career that I was unfamiliar with, which was the early career. I've watched, in preparation for this, The Killing, Paths of Glory, and Spartacus. I did not get around or get a chance to watch Lolita, and I'm not entirely sorry about that. Given the subject matter of that particular film, I've got to say, Stanley Kubrick is quite notorious. Every single film that he made was an adaptation of a novel of some kind. Why that one, Stanley? Why did it have to be that one? But obviously, you're much more familiar with this part of his career and these films than I am, and you have, sadly, watched Lolita, so you'll be able to...
I'm not going to sell you on this, am I? I was going to try. I thought I can bring Harry round. I'll talk about the artistic merits.
Oh, yeah.
And the witty repartee.
You're going to give me the BBFC sales pitch. See, there's a lot of artistic merit to this.
Would you care to guess who said, actually, this film is just absolutely grand when it was shown to him in the BBFC offices?
Oh, what was his name? Trevelyan? What was his name? Yeah, that, I was expecting that gentleman. Yes. So this was your idea. What was it that made you want to discuss Stanley Kubrick's film career?
I try and focus my channel on horror and deeper horror analysis, but there's only so far I can stretch it without absolutely taking the pee. But I thought, I know an interesting chap who does his research, who is pretty darn good on films when I've had you on talking about horror. And I heard that you're a bit of a Kubrick appreciator. In fact, you were on Contemplations very recently, the last Contemplations, saying that he was one of your favourite directors.
Yes, but sadly, Josh was unavailable for this filming, so I had to sit in instead. Yes, I do. Like I said, he is one of my favourite directors, and it's kind of undeniable that when he tried to make a particular kind of genre film, that he would end up making, almost by accident sometimes, the best of that particular genre, at least of the films that I've seen. Once again, my viewing of some of his films have been quite limited, but I am familiar with Dr. Strangelove, 2001, The Shining. I've watched a bit of Clockwork Orange. I'm a big fan of Full Metal Jacket. Of that latter period of his career, the ones that I haven't really watched have been Clockwork Orange in full. I've not got around to watching Barry Lyndon. I've heard that's quite an epic, similar in length to Spartacus, and also Eyes Wide Shut, which is quite controversial as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I'm almost viewing a lot of this as a road to Eyes Wide Shut, which is, you know, maybe ham-fisted, but narratively it's perfect because that is his last film. But I see so many things building up on the way to that, little hints that he's going to get there. Exactly as you said, he almost never writes his own story. He takes someone else's work, but interestingly, how can I say, he really does not feel bound to follow it much at all. Like, he'll take something, he'll absolutely hollow it out, chuck away key elements, do what he thinks needs to be done for the story. And that leads to quite a few feuds. When we end up, we won't manage it this session, but when we talk about The Shining, that is one of the famous feuds. And Arthur C. Clarke with 2001.
Interestingly, Bo was talking to me this morning before we began filming about Stanley Kubrick, and because he was interested in this discussion, and he was saying that he was listening to an interview that Arthur C. Clarke had done about his novelization, because I believe 2001 was conceptualized as a film that Kubrick went to Arthur C. Clarke to help him write, and then Clarke expanded the story, made it a little bit less ambiguous and abstract what happened at the end in his novelization of it. But Clarke was talking about how Kubrick was some kind of mathematical genius, as well as being an incredibly precise and diligent filmmaker. And I've read somewhere that supposedly Kubrick's IQ was something up there like 200. I don't know the accuracy of that, but he was obviously a genius, no matter which way you slice it, especially if somebody like Arthur C. Clarke is saying that he was a mathematical genius of the kind that even he couldn't comprehend when they were discussing some of the more scientific elements of the 2001 story.
Oh, absolutely. He was described by, I won't say Adrian Corey, I could be very wrong on there, but he was described as like an intellectual vampire, that you would meet him and he would just grill you and grill you about whatever you were interested in. And the subjects would go all over the place into these really obscure areas. It's like it's prime internet autism, way before the days of that.
He would have been on pole if he was around these days.
Oh, absolutely. You know, he's there before 2001 importing Japanese satellite photography and Japanese technical specifications for rocket models and all that stuff.
And he was quite the innovator. I mean, you mentioned The Shining. That's notorious, as you mentioned, of him having no real respect for the source material that he was working off, to the point where Stephen King absolutely hated it, because Stephen King is screeching, going, how can you have The Shining without the hedge monsters? How can we have the story? And then, of course, he tries to adapt it himself and everybody goes, this is laughable.
Damn it, I want that spooky haunted fire hose back in stat.
Yeah, how dare he turn this into a story about the horrors of the human condition and a family breaking apart? It's about a haunted hotel, goddammit, says mega genius Stephen King, who is probably at least three standard deviations below Stanley Kubrick. But Kubrick on The Shining also innovated with his use of Steadicam technology. From what I'm aware, there are those very famous tracking shots where you get the Steadicam camera operator following behind Danny, and then later in the film following behind Jack as he's traveling through the hedge maze. And as far as I'm aware, nobody had really used that technology before in film, and certainly that was one of the most effective ways to use it. So it wasn't even that he was an innovator, it's that when he got an innovation, he was able to already do incredible things with it to really elevate his films.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you're so right. That technology had really like only just come out. It had turned up in Rocky and I want to say Bound for Glory. But you look at that and you don't think, oh, Rocky, yeah, great Steadicam. Like it was used in it, but it was not used to the full potential. Whereas Kubrick saw, I've got a Steadicam. I can redesign my entire set around it and I can do shots that no one else has done. And when I was doing the research for this, I was watching Paths of Glory. How can I forget a name this early on? Paths of Glory. Early on, that trench shot where they're just going through and it's kind of unbroken. I watched that and I thought, oh, this is a dude who wants to make The Shining.
Yes, I was watching that for the first time, as I said, with The Killing, Paths of Glory and Spartacus. This was my first time watching all three of those films. The Killing and Paths of Glory, I thought, were excellent in their own right. Spartacus, I will have to say straight away, I did not enjoy very much. I found it to be an absolute slog. And
Harry, how could... Yeah, obviously, it's terrible.
As far as I'm aware, Kubrick was somewhat of a director for hire on that one in a way that he wasn't for most of the other projects he got involved with. A lot of the other projects were films that he was very passionate about, whereas this was Kirk Douglas had worked with him prior on Paths of Glory. They needed a director for the film, so he went, okay, hit up Stanley, he'll do a good job. But it really felt like a historical epic of the kind that any director who was doing historical epics in that 1950s to 1960s period could have done. Whereas Paths of Glory, like you say, Spartacus didn't have that same feeling of innovation in the way that he was doing some of the, filming some of the shots. I did find it impressive when there's the scene of the slaves facing off against the Roman soldiers and there's the big shot of the Roman soldiers all going into formation. And it looked as though that was done, I can imagine at the time, it must have been done practically using actual trained extras moving in formation. That was very impressive, but that was the only real aspect of that film that felt like Kubrick was playing with it and having fun with it the way that he does with other things. But Paths of Glory, when they go over the top and they're in no man's land, and you get lots of those POV shots following the soldiers, it really felt like you were on the ground. I was thinking as I was watching that, of all of the historical films set in the First and Second World War up to this point, I can't recall another film before then that had shot the action in such a visceral sense. It really felt like a precursor to the way that Steven Spielberg would do Saving Private Ryan, the opening scene at Normandy. So I thought that was very interesting that even back then, he's going like, okay, there's this thing where we could have a Steadicam just a single stationary camera shot panning across as they all go through the field. Or we could have all of these interconnecting shots where we get in really deep in there in the trenches with them and follow them. We're right behind them, really put the viewer in the feet, in the shoes of those soldiers as they're...
Yeah, the motion is there, isn't it? You're carried along with them as well. Mm. But you're just... You have so many chaps that you can sort of focus on, but they're just getting picked off, and it's almost like he frames it so you're like, okay, this is a guy I'm going to watch. Oh, he's gone. And then that one, no, he's gone. It's really subtle how he gets your eyes to follow them and just see them taken out.
Yes, one by one.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd done a technique there where he'd basically got all the, they were German policemen, I believe, playing French soldiers. For some reason, I can't put my finger on, the French authorities were not particularly fond of Paths of Glory.
Really? Well, I can imagine why, to be perfectly honest. Well, that's one of the things, we'll get to it, but I had some questions about the depictions of the High Command and the generals in Paths of Glory, because I imagine, obviously, it was specifically intended to be an anti-war film. So it had a message and it had a theme that it wanted to convey. And I was curious, being that I'm not too much of a buff on the actual trench warfare of the First World War, I'm not entirely sure how accurately the High Command were being depicted or how charitably they were being depicted. I would especially say that the general, the primary general in that, the man who looks like a Bond villain with scarred face, was being portrayed almost cartoonishly evil when at one point he orders his artillery command to fire on his own men to get them to get out of the trenches on this obvious suicide mission.
It's a bit over the line, isn't it?
It felt like it was being a caricature. It fell into the cartoonish depiction. But from my cultural touch points that I have for the First World War, outside of if I were to actually go and watch documentaries like, I think Peter Jackson did that coloured documentary of the First World War. What was it? We Shall Remember Them, or Those Who Shall Be Remembered, something like
that. I haven't seen it.
I apologise that I can't recall the name of it. Outside of that and doing some really intense reading on it, my cultural touch points for that are things like now Paths of Glory, like Blackadder Goes Forth, where the High Command, where the military commanders, the generals, were depicted as cartoonish buffoons or just outright evil in many cases. And I wonder how accurate that is to the realities of the situation. Please feel free to let me know in the comments below if that is how those generals actually were.
I think there's a certain amount of the inevitability of mass and scale means that you end up making these decisions that are almost cartoonishly evil. Like really weirdly, this is going to be such a swerve, but I was watching this documentary series called Wartime Farm, which was from a team who try and live on a farm in a different period. So they did Victorian, they did Tudor, they did Edwardian. And when they go to wartime, they want to vary the formula a bit because there's only so differently you do raising chickens, okay? But they end up filling the documentary with these tales of the government just coming in and being so authoritarian, ordering them off the land, ordering them what to do. You've got to have these super thick curtains on. You must block all light from your abode. We will come around and inspect you. It's so absolute tyrannical. You have a few stories of farmers who'd been told to relinquish their farm, kill off their livestock, and a farmer who just refused to do it, and they ended up shooting him. He got into a standout, and I was just thinking, this is really inhumane. This is kind of decision you make when you're talking about a war of mass and scale, and people just stop mattering.
And to be fair, in my own personal research that I've been doing recently, watching podcasts and listening to audiobooks on things like the Waco incident and like the Randy Weaver and his family in the US, it's not outside of the realm of possibilities that governments do take dissidents who are essentially trying to mind their own business. They want to be able to raise cattle on their own land, and they will, if they decide that you are a threat in doing so, come and do horrible and inhumane things to you and then portray themselves as the good guys on the other side of that. Thank you, ATF. You provide such an excellent service to the American people.
Hey, you don't know if they're the good guys yet. We have to see the history book first.
Then of course, we'll the know. FBI spread propaganda saying that David Koresh was a paedophile the day that they decided to go and assault his compound. So therefore, they were the good guys the whole time. Anyway, so
back to Kubrick.
back to Kubrick. Yes. So I started this off by watching The Killing, but I'm aware that he had done films prior to The Killing, a short film that was similar to Paths of Glory that was anti-war, and then what was it, The Killer's, Kiss. I did not watch either of those. Do you have experience with them?
Shamefully, I didn't watch them either. But you know what? I view that as a tribute to Stanley, who disavowed them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, oh, okay. Because I'm aware that most people who rate his films tend to either avoid or brush over them very quickly. Yeah. So I didn't know that that was something that he would have two thumbs up for himself.
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to explore his character a bit, how he's weirdly a total controlling nightmare. This book I have here is Kubrick's Total Cinema, which looks at totalitarianism in his films.
Well, you've done quite a bit of research here. You've brought an entire Kubrick library here, including these ones that I've got beside me, the Stanley Kubrick Archives, which is a really wonderfully presented book.
That's
and
so
also
good.
A biography of Stanley Kubrick by John Baxter with this rather, I've got to say, rather cool image of Kubrick on the front there. That's a great picture.
He's very Chad, isn't he? Yeah, you have the two best ones, I was going to say. If anyone's doing their research, those are the cream of the crop. But yeah, we'll see a contrast between his sort of extreme control and in a weird way, a light touch. He's quite a contrast. And I've forgotten where I was going. We're talking about his early films. Yes, so he disavowed them. I think that's partially because in these early days, he doesn't have control. He really is scrabbling. He's at the mercy. He's working his way into the Hollywood system. And I think by the end of this talk, we'll get to him leaving that system and possibly dropping a little, how would you say, dropping a little hint about why he wants to leave the system in the final film we discuss, Lolita.
So that's quite similar in that case to David Lynch's experience with Dune, where he tried to have his name taken off of that production, especially in television reruns of it, because that lack of control really affected him, and he was ashamed of it and didn't want anything to do with it. I can understand the artistic impulse, but it's very interesting that after that, you see with both directors, there's a parallel that you can draw where after they get more and more control over their own projects, where they're able to produce something that's more true to their own creative visions. And I think there is an overlap that you can do there, because I'm aware that Kubrick said as much that he was very influenced by Eraserhead after that came out. And also, when you get to 2001, that final section of the film after he enters the wormhole, and you get all of the trippy imagery, and then you get into the non-linear progression of events when he's being held in that observation room. When I watched that with my fiance, she turned to me and said, "I bet Lynch really loved this part of this film, didn't he?" And I said, "Yeah, probably, especially that overbearing, haunting soundtrack that he includes in it." But we'll get to that when we get to 2001.
I would love to think that Lynch sees 2001, gets all fired up, and then he's making Eraserhead, and then Kubrick later sees Eraserhead, and he screened it for everyone watching The Shining, saying basically, "This is what I'm trying to do."
That makes sense. That makes sense. Of directors who aren't actually horror, but are kind of horror, and like can create more unnerving and unsettling imagery and atmosphere than most horror directors, I would put Kubrick and Lynch up there. Outside of The Shining, Kubrick's films weren't really horror, but in parts of Full Metal Jacket, parts of 2001, he creates such a thick atmosphere of dread that you don't even get in most genre pictures.
Yeah, but you know, just as you said, he doesn't become pigeonholed into one genre. He goes through, and I would agree, he basically takes a genre, makes the best film in that genre, leaves, refuses to elaborate. Actually, refuses to elaborate is genuine. You run out of Kubrick interviews very soon because he stops talking to journalists.
I respect it.
Yeah.
I respect it. That's a very Chad move by Kubrick. If I was being hounded by journalists the whole time as well, I wouldn't want it. He must have taken one look at them, got the measure of them, and said, "I don't want to be associated with any of this."
Most definitely. And I think, you know, so much of it, not wanting to talk to journalists and spoon feed them the explanations. I think it's part of a piece with him wanting to exit the studio system. But I mean, we can probably explain that by looking at these early films, which I think most people won't go to. And as I said, Kubrick didn't want you to look at them either. The first one, Fear and Desire, Arthur Bryant. He did an Arthur Bryant Unfinished Victory and sort of bought up all the copies and tried to hide
them.
Yes. But
imagine that. It goes to show the different age we live in now, where if something's been released and it's on the internet, you'll never get rid of it. But back then, because it was also so physical in the media, you could go like, oh, my first film was terrible. Well, let me just burn all of the copies of that then.
Yeah, and he tried to do it. And that was a kind of amateurish production, but we've got to be impressed with him. He is a really young guy, barely 20, early 20s, getting that together. He'd got the money from it from a couple of hustles. So one of them, he was a chess hustler.
Oh, I heard that he was some kind of chess whiz.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that plays into his life a lot. And you may have noticed that scene with the chess club in The Killing, where he hires a big heavy guy from that.
Yes.
That is very cribbed from his own life. He used to haunt the chess clubs a lot.
It felt like it was... It felt like it was coming off of real experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he'd go around Central Park and he would just play these games, and you'd play them for money and try and kind of like pool hustling. But he would do it with chess, and he would look out for what he called putzers, or which I think is where we get the word patsy.
Is that Yiddish?
Mark. It is. I mean, I think it's probably if we're going to understand Kubrick, it probably is best if we look at his early life.
All right.
And just sort of check that out to get a good understanding of it.
That's a dangerous territory you're getting us into already, Chloe. You're trying to get me kicked off this website.
I don't know what you mean.
Have you not seen the symbolism right next to you right there, that Lotus L? What's it in? Oh, dear.
Oh, no.
No, yeah, of course. Stanley Kubrick was a Jewish man, and I can see perhaps with Paths of Glory and with Spartacus, how that would inform some of his idealism that he would display in those films. Spartacus, once again, he's more of a director for hire, but that film was very clearly, to me, inspired somewhat by the Jewish experience and also by the communist background of the writers, both Howard Fast, who wrote the novel that it was based off of, and also... Donald Trumbo, who wasn't Jewish, but he was a member of the Communist Party who was blacklisted from Hollywood. We'll get into that as we get to that film. But what would you say his early life is informing throughout the rest of his career?
Well, you remember how he said he was basically a genius? This is going to feel like a shameless reach, but we're so far into the discussion that this isn't going to be like an algo grab. But I was really reminded of Elon Musk and Mr. Beast. I've been listening to an Elon Musk bio. Like, both of those guys in school were not doing well. They weren't engaging. Elon Musk was tested for retardation.
Really?
Yeah.
My goodness.
They couldn't engage, basically. And Kubrick, same thing. Terrible grades, couldn't engage, was not interested, had his IQ tested because I wondered if that was a thing.
God, he's a super genius.
It's just the school system was torturously... tediously dull for him, for all of them, actually.
So. I would imagine so, because I didn't realise that Mr. Beast was also of that ilk. That's very impressive, to be fair. I mean, I always wondered how that man is able to make so much money and throw it away so willy-nilly, but, you know, fair play to the guy.
It's that just not thinking in a conventional way, not thinking in a standard way. You can't just put them in a standard process. So I was looking at those guys. I just saw that connection with Kubrick. He doesn't get on in school, but he's gifted at 13 a Graflex camera. I provide a whole bunch of photos. I put a slideshow together so we can hopefully see some of those images. It's a heavy old clunky beast. But in 1945, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt dies, Kubrick...
Finally.
Yeah, he skipped school. Oh, you're not a fan, Harry?
No, I'm not a fan.
I'm shocked.
The New Dealers, no, not big on those guys.
So he skips school, he sees an opportunity, goes out with his camera, goes to a newsstand and takes a shot of a news vendor surrounded by the headlines looking kind of dejected. This is a staged shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, staging shots of historical events in that.
Oh, yes, true. Similar to how Rosa Parks, all of the most famous photographs from that was actually a photo shoot.
Precisely, precisely. So, but it's meant to look like verite. And he takes this shot of the news vendor. He sells it to Look Mag. Well, he actually shops it around, which shows just some nous, some drive. And he gets $25 for it, which, okay, who cares? Inflation calculator, looking at that, that was $428. And he's like 14.
That fair play.
Sorry. He might be he's in his teens, basically.
Yes. I mean, I broke out the inflation calculator when I was watching The Killing to see, okay, $2 million, that's the overall take for this. Mm. How much is that in modern money? It was $22 million split between, what was it, five or six guys? I thought, okay, yeah that's worth it. That's definitely worth it.
I didn't look to do that, but I was just struck by this. So like this hustling with a camera. So he just drops out of school. He can't be bothered with it. He goes into the bullpen of photography magazines where you go out on assignment with these rough older guys, and he's there like this.
I'm going to show you the tricks of the trade, kid. That kind of attitude.
Yeah. Like tough New Yorkers, right? And he's there being like tiny with his camera. But it just shows that drive and hustle. And that's how he gets some money for Fear and Desire, which, as he said, was kind of amateurish. It was set in a nondescript war setting. I'm afraid that John Baxter there does try and read into a theme of a kind of sexual preoccupation with bound women. I really like that book, but I thought that was
Is Baxter a bit of a psychoanalysis Freudian type if he's trying to draw that kind of analysis into it?
I didn't even think he was. It came out of nowhere. I didn't think it was convincing at all.
A lot of Freudian sexual psychoanalysis these days is so ingrained into people from such a young age without even realizing it, that I think that people do look for these strange psychosexual readings of things without realizing where it comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. It's otherwise great book, but that was a total reach anyway. So, and there's sort of that theme in there already of like the cruelties of war, but he said it was all very amateurish, but the fact that he managed to get that made on basically no budget with his first wife, Toba Metz, being brought along to sort of, what do you say, like be a runner, be a dog's body, do everything, shows that he can do it. Like, he's only been working the camera for a few years and then he goes up to film. And then from that, he's going up to make his next feature, which is Killer's Kiss. And in that one, actually some alternative titles for you. He farms out the idea to it of basically, how can I say, some kind of pulp writers. Mm. Just like, I've got this location. I need a shootout here. Oh, so can you get me these scenes?
It's almost like he's doing a collage of different ideas and trying to stitch them together afterwards.
Yeah, it's shamelessly commercial. It's designed to just be a genre piece to go on the B-movie circuit. But it does show some competence. So alternative titles, Kiss Me, Kill Me? No?
These are classic pulpy titles. I like it.
The Nymph and the Maniac. No? All right, no. Well, Killer's Kiss is what he ended up going with. That comes out, 53, 54, something like that. Again, early 20s he's doing this. And it just about makes its money back. Kubrick learns at this point, by the way, that actors will basically work for free.
If anybody's ever done a student picture, then you can find that most actors are not Hollywood superstars. They have dreams of being Hollywood superstars, but they are not. And they will be willing to star in any tripe to be able to get their foot on that ladder.
Absolutely. And so he's got no money. He realizes from Fear and Desire that actors will work for free. From Killer's Kiss, he realizes he can basically get the equipment for free. Just renting it out and be like, I'll sort it. If it makes money, I'll pay you that back. And eventually he was able to do that. But neither of these are ones he's proud of or thinks is really all that good. He recycled some elements of Killer's Kiss for the boxing sections. It's basically, it's about a boxer who meets a woman who has this obsessive business guy, basically try and kidnap her, and he has to rescue her. She's the dame in distress. Irene Kane plays the woman and she says, she's so completely confused by the film because all the endings keep changing. And she doesn't know in the end, is she the good guy? Is she the bad guy? And that kind of presages how Kubrick is going to be extremely improvise a lot, not work with solid scripts and drive actors a tiny bit crazy with his antics.
I wasn't aware that he was an improvisational director, because I know that there are a few directors who work like that. To bring it back to my general point of reference again, Lynch is one of the most famous to do this for me, because Mulholland Drive, failed TV pilot, basically gets rejected because the person he sent it to didn't watch it. And said, no, we're not having this, it's a bit boring. So then he improvises an entire last third of the film to try and draw all of the disparate plot threads together. And especially with Inland Empire, which he has said was just a series of improvisational scenes without scripts that he started filming with his friend Laura Dern. And then he managed to get the nexus of an idea going, the nucleus of an idea, and stitches it all together. I wasn't aware, because Kubrick's so known as the most meticulous director you could work with, that he would improvise in such a way. I know, you know, I'm well aware of over 100 takes for certain scenes of The Shining. I can only imagine how much detail went into the filming of 2001. But he was doing some of that not knowing exactly where it was going to go sometime.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.